If it works.
For writing, right?
This is tape 3, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. We are interviewing Dr. Howard Mermelstein again at his office. The date is December 27, 1990. And the interviewer this time is Gabrielle Dinman, and the recorder is Mary Harrison. Dr. Mermelstein, we have all sorts of information about all your father's siblings, but we notice in our notes we don't have his name. Please give it to us. Give us your father's name.
Morris, M-O-R-R-I-S, Morris Mermelstein.
Right. Okay. We also want to fill in a few more spots. You graduated from high school in 1942.
Mm-hmm. Ambridge High
School. Right. Did a year at Pitt, then you went to MIT, then to medical school. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us, please, how was this funded at that time?
How was?
Your education funded.
My father did partial funding. I had an honor scholarship to Pitt, and at MIT, I ended up in V-12, the Navy V-12. Came back to Pitt Medical School via the Philadelphia Naval Hospital. I was a corpsman at the Philadelphia Naval Hospital. And was sent back to medical school. I was V-12 there for the first year or so. And then I reverted back to partial scholarship. And my father's good devices.
So that was the war over by then?
The war was over while I was in medical school.
In medical school. So when the war was over, the V-12 funding stopped.
Stopped, right.
Okay. And that's why you were not in the service until after the war.
Well, I was in the service. I was Navy V-12, though.
Okay.
And I was at the Philadelphia Naval Hospital as a corpsman in between MIT, which I didn't graduate from MIT because I left for medical school before I was graduated. I was 8 credits short of college graduation. So I actually didn't get my degree, my college degree, until I finished 2 years of medical school. So I got my BS in 1946, and I got my MD in 1948. But they made it a combination. It was an accommodation they did during the war, actually, for many people.
I see. That was not uncommon.
No, not at all.
Right. Okay, so we've got that. So you were actually at MIT for 1 year?
No.
Pitt one year.
And then
MIT
I had all the rest of my credits except for 8 credits at MIT.
At MIT. So what dates were you at MIT, do you remember?
Oh, hell.
We do have it?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Guess.
How about asking the cost of the education?
Okay. Do you remember the cost of the education?
Remember the cost here?
Yeah.
I don't have an idea. But all I remember my father saying, Howard, as long as you're in school, as long as you're a resident, as long as you're whatever, you're funded. Once you get out, you're on your own because there ain't going to be nothing left. And that was it. Okay. Education to him was paramount, and my mother. And as long as Eleanor and I would go to school, they were thrilled, and they'd find it somewhere to give. But they made it clear to me once I was out, and they were right. I was on my own, and rightfully so.
Okay, very good.
I told my kids the same thing, but they don't believe it. Different generation.
Now, we do have all the information about your internship, your residency, and how you became interested in pediatrics. You talked during our first interview a bit about Korea and what you did there at the hospital with the children. Can you give us a physical description of was it Busan where you were?
Well, when I first went in, I went in as port surgeon at Incheon, Korea, the port of Incheon, which is north. It's up the Yellow Sea. And I was in Incheon as port surgeon, and our headquarters was in an old schoolhouse. right near Charlie Pier, which was the main pier. Incheon has the second highest tide in the world. It's a 30-foot tide. So that when the tide's in, you're up to the pier. When the tide's out, ships can't come in. So they're out in the outer harbor. They've been in an outer harbor. The night we came in to land in Incheon, pitch black, freezing cold, and our ship couldn't come in. So we had to go off a Jacob's ladder off the side of the ship. I had brand new combat boots, which really didn't work too well. Someone had to take my feet and take me on down the Jacob's ladder into a landing craft. Then when we got to the shore, to get up to the pier, we had to crawl, climb back up another bit. That's when we were re-interviewed again, and I was assigned to be the port surgeon. Others in our group went up as battalion aid stations, and others went into station hospitals in the area. During the time I was in Incheon, we had a lot of children who were, their parents were either killed or lost somewhere along the way during the war, as the Chinese, well, the Chinese had just come in at that time, as the North Koreans and the South Koreans were going back and forth. And we had a couple of Korean children living with us. And the reason it's so well in, set in my mind at this point is on Thanksgiving Day.
What year?
Just this,
oh, this
year.
Okay, excuse me.
On Thanksgiving Day of this year, my 7-year-old grandson had been watching television. I don't know whether I mentioned this before. And at that time, Bush was visiting the troops in Saudi Arabia. And he said to his mother, my daughter, Margie, Mommy, why are all the soldiers over there? And she explained that they were there to protect and what American soldiers were, and casually mentioned that Papa, who I am, was in a war, and he was over in Korea, and he wanted to know all about Korea. When they came over for dinner, he couldn't wait. Papa, tell me, oh, do you have any pictures? Do you have anything to remember when you were in Korea? So I went through all the old pictures with him and described what it was to be over there. And he wanted to know if I had any old uniforms. I didn't even realize we had them. Beverly had them stashed away. And he got my old Navy formal cap, my overseas cap, and he now wears to school each day the cap that I wore in Korea with the ear lugs and all.
Oh, wow.
And he was so excited. And he wanted to know if I had any boots. And unbeknownst to me, Beverly had my combat boots put away. And the kid put the boots on. He's only 7, of course, I have a size 13 foot. And Eleanor, my sister, said, Seth, do those shoes fit you? And he said, oh, yes. So he put them on, and when he went to go up the steps out of our family room into the first level, it was the most difficult thing I've ever seen a kid do in my life, lifting his feet. But he lifted them, and he got up the steps. But when it came time to leave to go home, he insisted they take it all, because he was afraid that Nana would put them away again. He has all my old Army gear and Navy gear, and he was quite impressed. It was a fun day for me. And anyway, when I started to say, I showed him some pictures of some little boys that stayed in the schoolhouse with us, my headquarters. And as a matter of fact, I came across a letter while I was going through all this stuff for him from the little boy, the one little boy, who was sort of my mascot. And he wanted to watch when I left, when I ended up leaving there. He asked if I'd send him a watch. And when I got home to the States, I bought him a watch and sent him a watch. And he, the most beautiful thank you note I've ever received in my life. And it was to Dr. Mermelstein, sir. And written, you could tell his Korean inflection. And it was a most impressive letter for my grandchildren to hear, too. But it was these little side things that make the service a very different kind of thing. You can make out of the service what you want. It can be miserable, it could be a learning experience, and mine was a learning experience. I was scared to death the whole time I was over there, but it was a very learning experience. In Korea, now when we were evacuated from Incheon, the only thing between us and the outer harbor where the battleships were was a group of military police, because the rest had all flown. They were all going south, not for the winter, but for their lives. And the Chinese were coming. And the only thing between the Chinese and us, there were two battleships out in the outer harbor, and they were peppering shells in so that they really couldn't get close. And the military police were in a line, about 1,000 yards north of us would be the last line, because we couldn't get off. This was in the afternoon, and we loaded our ambulance and all our belongings onto a landing ship tank, an LST, a Japanese manned LST, and we couldn't get off because the tide didn't come in until 2 a.m. So we had to wait till the tide came in and floated the LST off the beach. Then we were able to go out into the outer harbor and on down through the LC onto Pusan. And that was a scary time.
What's the date?
That date?
Yeah.
Would have been about the first week in January of 1951.
That's when you left Incheon for Pusan.
Uh-huh, left Incheon for Pusan. Okay. It took us about 2.5 days. We went down in a terrible storm. Everybody got sick on the ship. I don't know how I did, and I had IVs hanging all over the place. There was only one other doctor on the ship, and he got sick, and I had an IV in him, too. And I guess I was too busy to get sick, so I didn't. And ended up down in Pusan, and that's where I was assigned to a second logistical command, and that we have, a second logistical command.
Right.
And that's when I helped found this children's hospital in an orphanage.
Right.
The description of that is an old building, frame, many rooms. The troops in the area, because we got them involved, painted it. And really, for Korea, for Pusan at that time, it ended up a very attractive wooden ramshackle place that we called the Pusan Children's Hospital. At that time, it was called Happy Mountain Orphanage.
It was called that before you got
Happy
there?
Happy Mountain Orphanage. No, we named it Happy Mountain Orphanage.
You named, okay.
We named it Happy Mountain Orphanage. And then, after I left, is when it became actually Pusan Children's Hospital. It became affiliated with the medical school in Pusan, and it still is. It's the first children's hospital they ever had in Korea in 4,000 years.
I think we have
that. We have that.
Okay, now what was the date that you landed in Incheon? Do you know that? Or the year, anyhow?
Landed in Incheon?
Yes.
In Incheon?
Yes.
Well, that would have been November 1950.
November. Okay.
I was only there from November 1950 until the Chinese invited us out in January of 51.
Okay.
The rest of the time was down in Pusan.
Okay.
And I was in Pusan until June of 1951, and then got my orders to come home. At that time, I was assigned to the Marines. From being on temporary duty with the Army, and being a Navy doctor, we did the medical bit for the Marines. And I wasn't in the Marines too long, because I let them know I learned the hard way. I didn't want to learn all over again. And they did decide to send me to a dependence clinic in Norfolk.
Okay, let's talk about that. That was on my list. Can you elaborate? You want to go back to Pusan?
What the city of Pusan, what it physically looked like?
We talked about that.
City of Pusan? City of Pusan, at that time, was a very busy, very dirty, very smelly city. Many refugees from the north. Many children down there who were separated from their parents through no fault of the parents or of the kids. It was just it became mayhem at times with the war, which incidentally was not called a war. Korean whatever, and Korean conflict, I guess. But the area that I lived in was a bunch of tents behind where our logistical command was. It was right beside what they called the railroad station. The railroad station was the marshaling area for anyone coming in or leaving Pusan. And then off of the railroad station area was the harbor. And out sitting in the harbor, in and out, were two Navy hospital ships. The Navy hospital ship Hope and the Navy hospital ship Repose. And also out in that harbor was a Danish hospital ship called the Jutlandia, J-U-T-L-A-N-D-I-A.
L-A-N-D-I-A.
And that is where we sent any of our children from this Pusan, from this Happy Mountain Orphanage, who had head wounds or anything like that. A neurosurgeon was in charge of the Jutlandia, and they put a room aside for our kids. And so we really organized. I think we mentioned before about how we got various American physicians from the various station hospitals and hospitals around the area of Pusan and various specialties. They were all in training when they got in, so none of them were fully trained yet, but they all had enough experience and knew what to do. We had an orthopedist, anesthesiologist, surgeons, we had an internist who turned pediatrician through us, and Julie Barbaro and I were the two pediatricians. And we had a lot of help from the corpsman in the area, who it was sort of a respite for all of us to have something like this to do rather than just the mundane army chores.
So you sort of almost adopted them.
Oh yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Are there any other physical descriptions of Pusan?
Yes, not too far. We could see actually from where our tents were behind the logistical command area was a prisoner of war camp. And these were North Koreans, and they were doing all the dirty work, where they would do they'd clean out the latrines and they build any roads that had to be built. And they were treated and fed pretty well. Interestingly enough, a surgeon who was over there, who I bumped into, just coincidentally, in Pusan, hadn't been a year ahead of me at Pitt Med School, had surgical training, and it was absolutely unbelievable the amount of abdominal surgery he was doing. And I may turn your stomachs before lunch, but the most of his surgery was on patients with ascariasis.
A-S-C-A-R-I-A-S-I-S.
That's one of the worms, roundworms, and the ascaris would invade the gut, and they were so full of ascaris that they would perforate the viscus, and they had peritonitis, and these fellows used to go in and do surgery on these POWs, and it was amazing. I saw a couple of the surgical procedures. It really turned my stomach too, to see the free worms coming out of the bowel and stomachs of these POWs. So it was a different kind of thing. While I was there, I saw smallpox, which I never thought I'd ever see. I went to a leper colony, and that was just a visit. I have pictures of that, pictures of a woman breastfeeding her baby. These were interesting asides. There was a lot of medicine that I actually saw that I learned in medical school only because I was afraid some son of a gun was going to quiz me on it. So I learned it.
Okay.
But this became practical as to what we saw over there.
So, wars do. I can't say it's an upside, but certainly you would have never seen things like this.
Absolutely not. And you can make good out of bad.
Oh, sure.
Good out of bad.
If you don't learn from...
It was an unbelievable maturing experience for me. I think I grew up a lot. I was in Korea total of just from November through June. November 50 through June of 51. In that time, I think... It was probably the fastest maturation I had in my entire life.
Oh, I don't believe it. Okay, now can we talk about the dependency clinic? Is there anything...
In Korea? Oh, you mean in Norfolk?
Right.
Yeah, it was a great experience. 3 days after I got back to the States, I drove to Indianapolis, where Beverly, at that time was Beverly Seeley, Jesse L.I.G., lived. And 2 days later, we announced our engagement.
What's the date there?
We announced our engagement in, I think it was July of, oh hell, it was early July.
Okay.
And...
What year?
1951.
Okay.
And I went back down to Norfolk, where I was stationed at the Naval Air Station. And then Beverly and I were married in October. October 25th, 1951, and drove from Indianapolis after the wedding, and we stayed in New York. We had a honeymoon for a week in New York. Matter of fact, we stayed at the Plaza Hotel. That was before Trump's day, and we left. We got there, as a matter of fact, the day we were married, October 25th, it was a gorgeous day in Indianapolis. We were in shirt sleeves. And a week later, when we left New York, we left in a snowstorm on the way to Naval Air Station. And then we had a marvelous year's honeymoon while I was at the Naval Air Station. We lived off base, not too far from the base, and I served in a dependence clinic.
Okay, what does that mean?
Dependence means, well, I was assigned to, it was called the Ben Morrell housing area. Ben Morrell, who lived here in Pittsburgh, who was married to Seal Frank.
Mm-hmm.
That's Joan Epp's mother. It was Joan Epp's stepfather, Ben Morrell. And they named it after him. He was an admiral during World War II. At any rate, this was a large housing area. And in the middle of it, there was a large clinic, a Navy clinic. But the Navy clinic didn't just serve Navy. It served Army, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, anybody in the service. And we were the pediatric end. I had to have certain night duty at the Naval Air Station. That's who I was attached to. But I was sent to the dependence clinic, which meant the dependent children of the service people in the area were served free at the dependence clinic in the Ben Morrell housing area. And I had a tremendous experience there. There were so many children. And we organized that too. We were lucky enough to have enough fellows who were interrupted in the middle of their residency who wanted to continue their education. We even arranged to have what we called grand rounds every Saturday morning at Portsmouth, which was a naval hospital outside of Norfolk, Portsmouth, Virginia. And every Saturday morning we'd take off for 3 hours and make grand rounds at the hospital there in the pediatric end. And we had a marvelous time. Bev and I had a great time.
What was Bev doing?
At that time?
Yeah.
She was taking care of her new husband. And we just had a ball. My hours were marvelous. And we made very, very good friends of some natives in Norfolk. I'll never forget Henry Van Ose.
Please.
V-A-N, capital V-A-N, capital O-S. Henry and his wife, she was a big Girl Scout, and they were Jewish. And somehow the Van Oses took us under their wing. And their children, one of their children was married to Mel Crocken. Mel Crocken belonged to an old family in the Norfolk area, too. They had a furniture store in Portsmouth. And Mel and Betty Crocken were just marvelous to us. And we would go to temple with them. And we had them to our apartment. They had us to their house. They had a beach house down in Virginia Beach that we used to visit frequently. There was just so much to do in that area. Beverly did not work as employable work. She did, as she does now, a lot of volunteer work. She had graduated from Indiana University in Bloomington that June that I was coming home. While I was coming home from Korea, she was graduating. And she had a degree in social work. did not do any work at that particular point. And we just did a lot of traveling around the area and just had a marvelous first year of marriage. Then came back to Pittsburgh, where I resumed my residency.
Right. I think that information we have pretty much. Now let's go continue with your early, after the residency. Where was your first office in Pittsburgh?
My first office was supposed to be at 3347 Forbes, but it wasn't ready when I started. So I had to find a place to plant my feet for about 6 months until the building was ready. And I ended up in the old medical building, which is now part of Carlo College, which is the corner of Chesterfield and Fifth Avenue. And I shared space. I think we have this on tape. I shared space with Dr. Shube.
No, we don't have that.
Shared.
How do you spell that, Shube?
What it used to be, you'd get off an elevator in every floor. I think it was a 5-floor building. In each floor, you get off the elevator, and it was a tremendous waiting room. And then there were offices off of the waiting room. And the offices that I shared, there was Tom Shube, who was the surgeon, S-H-U-B, or S-C-H-U-B, who was at that time, he was the surgeon of Montefiore Hospital. And Tom Shube, Dr. Kamen, I forget which Kamen it was. He was a Dr. Kaufman's department store, too. He was an internist, was on that floor. Stanley Rosenblum was out a couple of years, I guess 3 or 4 years before that. He was on that floor. Shep Isaacson, who since has died, was an internist, was on that floor. And little me, I think I owned a couple of patients, and that was it.
So you were the only pediatrician?
On that floor? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And not a very busy one at that point either. I just opened the doors. And at that time, I'll never forget, Dr. Dave Steinman, a marvelous man, who was a pediatrician, called me down to his office. And he said, Howard, I understand you're waiting to open your new office down in the new building. And I said, yes. He asked me how much rent I was going to pay, and I told him. And he said, I want to give you a little advice. He said, I've been in practice, I don't know at that time, whether it was 25 years or 30 years, whatever it was. Did you see my office? He says, I've got a consultation room, and I've got an examining room. He said, my overhead is nil. And he said, that's the way you do it. And I felt, even though this was a marvelous man telling me this, if I had to spend the rest of my life doing it that way, no way. So I went ahead and did what I planned to do, and I had this suite that I took on in the 3347 Forbes building, which is right across from McGee, and it was the best move I could have made. Because
for history, can you tell us the rent?
At that time, it was the great number of probably $175 a month. Mm-hmm. That was a lot of money at that time. I first started out, I had well baby clinics, child health conferences for the county health department. They paid us a grand total of $25 a conference. And of course I was affiliated with Children's and I had a little extra income there. And I don't know how one, you know, people say, how do you start a practice? Well, it's different now than it used to be. But somehow it got from person to person. Didn't take long. I was getting busy.
Can we ask you again for history? What was the fee for an office visit?
Office visit was $5. The house call was $7.
Okay.
House call.
House call. That's an
acronym. I forget how you spell that.
And at that time, where did you and Bev first live in Pittsburgh?
While I was a resident, we lived at the corner of 5th and South Highland. We thought it was a marvelous apartment. It's still there. As you stop for the light coming west on 5th Avenue, it's corner of 5th and Highland, you'll see there's a little courtyard in this building, and there are windows on the first floor apartment. What do you call them, the round windows?
Bay
windows. And we had the first bay on the right. We thought it was marvelous. We had a one-bedroom apartment there. And then, when Beverly delivered Margie, our first child, that was June 25th. I was getting ready to go into practice July 1st. While she was in the hospital, we moved from that apartment, one bedroom, to a two-bedroom apartment, the corner of 5th and Aiken. That's still there. At that time, we thought they were lovely apartments, two bedrooms, and we had a porch off of it. We were up on the second floor. And then we bought a duplex. We still own it. We call it townhouse now. In Shadyside, corner of College and Elmer. And we moved there because we then had three children. And then from there, when we started to bulge out of there, and we had two children then, and we had the third child, we started to bulge, and that's when we moved to Squirrel Hill, our present home, which was August of 1962.
What was your first car?
Beverly's.
What kind?
It was a beautiful yellow Pontiac coupe that she got for graduation from college. That's why I married her. I needed a new car.
Nice. And you made your house call from that?
No, because, well, yes, I did. That was the beginning. And then I got a Buick. We had a Buick. I forget what model it was. And then from there, we went and when I first went into practice, Margie was born on the 25th of June, went into practice July 1st.